Thanks for choosing us, The Takeaway, for your listening pleasure. I'm John Hockenberry, and this is today's show. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. From crumbling infrastructure to sketchy security to suspicion of our trading partners, these have become defining issues this week as Congress and the White House, urban leaders and lawmakers debate nothing less than what is the role of government. A number of important voices today on the program, and we begin with Senator Ron Wyden, a Democrat from Oregon who also sits on the Senate Intelligence Committee and has serious disagreements with the White House over the Trans-Pacific Partnership, over the collection of domestic communications data by the NSA, and a whole range of other issues we will explore with him today. Senator Wyden, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
It's kind of like Jeopardy here. I'll take a Trans-Pacific Partnership for 50. Let's start with that. Where does the Democratic compromise with Senator Schumer stand right now in terms of getting over the objections of Democrats here?
We have been able to secure an approach that seems to satisfy the overwhelming majority of Democrats in the United States Senate. We are going to start with what I think is a key aspect of trade policy that all Democrats agree on, and that is more robust enforcement of our trade laws. A lot of Americans say, what's the point of talking about new trade deals if you aren't enforcing the laws on the books? And I can tell you there's a lot of cheating. I remember a few years ago, I had to set up a sting operation in order to catch individuals overseas from merchandise laundering. They would, in effect, get apprehended for a violation, and then they would just ship through somewhere else. So we're starting with what I think is appropriate, tougher enforcement of our trade law.
Are you happy with the currency manipulation issues and how that's being dealt with in the partnership deal?
I supported Senator Michael Bennet's amendment. That's something that has the administration support. Senator Schumer has an alternative approach. The challenge here is to make sure that as we try to protect our workers, protect our companies, we not in any way impede the ability of the Federal Reserve to use the tools it needs to strengthen our economy. It is a fine balance. We're going to have to do some more work to achieve it.
All right. Let's talk about the NSA and the collection of domestic data in communications networks in the United States. In your view, a straight reauthorization of the NSA program is dead on arrival as far as Senator Wyden is concerned?
Absolutely. It is time to stop extending a bad law. In late February, the president extended this dragnet surveillance program that collects millions of law-abiding Americans' phone records. These extensions have been happening every 90 days for years now. I am going to be doing everything I can to make sure that the current extension is absolutely the last.
What is going on at the White House? On the one hand, the president suggests that he wants to roll back the program, but yet, as you say, they keep reauthorizing it.
The president does have the authority to end the program now. I think always we recognize it is a dangerous world. Anyone who sits on the Intelligence Committee knows that. I think that we, particularly with the Leahy bill, that Senator Leahy of Vermont, have struck the right balance. We're talking about reforming the law, and it is high time. And certainly yesterday's vote in the House to reform dragnet surveillance and bulk collection once and for all is a very good bit of new momentum for us. And it seems to me it will put a lot of pressure here in the Senate on moving in that direction.
Do you agree with the Second Circuit Court of Appeals ruling that bulk data collection is unconstitutional by the NSA to collect phone records?
I do. And people need to know that the phone records program, and we're talking about collecting millions and millions of phone records on law-abiding citizens, was a secret program propped up by secret law. And now a very important court has declared it to be unconstitutional and certainly they declared it to be illegal.
Right.
And I think it is very helpful to our cause.
But the Second Circuit says they're not going to do anything about it. It's up to Congress to actually enforce the illegality. And you talked about enforcing existing laws on the trade deal. What are you going to do about enforcing existing laws on this violation of Americans' rights?
What traditionally happens, and this has happened again and again in my 14 years on the Intelligence Committee, is those who are in favor of the status quo, and certainly the majority leader is for just reauthorizing what we have today, everybody waits until the very last minute. And then they say, oh, my goodness, it's a dangerous world. We just have to go along with what we've got. And I have made it very clear that I will not accept that again. I will filibuster any short-term extension of the Patriot Act without major reforms, particularly ending bulk phone record collection. That's usually what happens in these instances. And that's why I've indicated to your listeners, this is going to be the last time where, in effect, the Congress just rubber stamps the status quo.
Senator Wyden, would you pardon Edward Snowden for what he has done?
I have not been in the business of doing running commentary when someone is under criminal indictment. What I will tell you is I feel very strongly that this is a debate that should not have started in this way. It should have started with the leadership of the Intelligence Committee. And in fact, instead of starting the debate, the intelligence leadership in an open session when I asked point blank, does the government collect any type of data at all on millions of Americans? The head of the national intelligence community said no, which was obviously false.
He lied to you. The Intelligence Committee was briefed on this matter, didn't go to the American people. It seems to me that the accountability mechanisms on Capitol Hill don't work. Therefore, Snowden should be pardoned.
Well, first of all, and I gave a long address on it. If any listeners are having trouble sleeping, they can watch it on C-SPAN. I can tell you it is very, very difficult to make these cases stick. I remember when I was in the House, I asked the tobacco executives when they were under oath whether nicotine was addictive. It obviously is. They said, no, it wasn't possible to bring a case. What I can tell you is this is ultimately a decision for the president of the United States. What I've indicated is that it's my job to ask the tough questions. Mr. Snowden already indicated that one of the big factors in him releasing this information was he saw that Mr. Clapper had not been straight with the American people and the Congress. Now it's up to the president to decide what to do with respect to Mr. Clapper.
This isn't necessarily your committee assignment expertise, but nevertheless, looking at the situation in Philadelphia, do Americans have a right to expect a modern rail system in the United States and something that is not going to result in the kinds of accidents that we've seen in Philadelphia, even though we know that the cause hasn't been determined at this point?
Absolutely. And it is within the jurisdiction of the Senate Finance Committee. I'm the ranking Democrat. I've introduced a bipartisan piece of legislation with Senator Hoeven of North Dakota to create Move America bonds and Move America tax credits, and we could fund exactly the kind of infrastructure talking about passenger rail and other services.
On the story that's bouncing around the Beltway and out in areas of sort of journalistic investigation, what's your view on the U.S.-Pakistan relationship? Do you think bin Laden was an inmate or a hotel guest there in Pakistan when the Navy SEALs went into Abbottabad?
That information is classified. I can't get into that.
Do you know the answer?
Again, I just cannot talk about something that is highly classified.
All right. What do you make of the U.S.-Pakistan relationship? Forget about the latest allegations. Are they cooperative in the war on terror? Are they at odds with the United States and making a situation worse?
I would describe the relationship as problematic. Sometimes they are cooperative, and certainly there have been instances where that's been a challenge.
Are you satisfied that the White House is telling the truth to the American people about the apprehension of Osama bin Laden?
Everything that I know to date, the answer would be yes.
All right. Senator Wyden, in general, there's been a lot of disagreement between the White House and Democrats on issues of progressive economics, on issues of national security, and some of them you've outlined, and on the management of the economy. What would you say is the state of play between the White House and the Democratic leadership right now on the Hill?
On the overwhelming body of policy, and we're talking about issue after issue, infrastructure, minimum wage, cracking down on insurance company abuses in healthcare. There is overwhelming agreement with respect to the Democratic caucus. So, yes, there are differences of opinion on trade policy. There are differences of opinion in the country. But if you look at one issue after another, whether it's college student loans or housing policy, a whole host of issues, the Democratic caucus is very much in agreement.
Would you accept a draft as a running mate for Hillary Clinton in 2016?
I've said that I'm sort of the Senate's designated driver. You know, everybody's talking about some kind of national ticket. I think few people got to stay behind. We're not running for president or to be on a ticket. And we have to stay behind. We've got to work on the kind of issues we're talking about, ways to create more good-paying jobs, such as through exports, tax reform that takes away the tax breaks for shipping jobs overseas, helps our workers here at home. A intelligence policy to ensure that we are not sacrificing liberty to have security. I have been so honored to be able to represent Oregon in the United States Senate, and that's where I'm staying put.
All right. The designated driver of the U.S. Senate, Senator Ron Wyden, Democrat from Oregon. Always a delight, sir.
Thanks so much.
Was the raid on Osama bin Laden a triumph of covert operations, or was it the culmination of a very public dispute between Pakistan and the United States? Was Osama bin Laden hiding or being protected by Pakistan? Or worse, was he being held secretly as a prisoner, a possible bargaining chip Pakistan could deliver at any time?
Pakistan has long done this. They have safe houses where they either imprison people or they control them so they actually cannot leave and they have guards. But there are other safe houses where they have a sort of consent to living there and they're kind of watched and controlled, but also they're sort of like a guest. So I think Bin Laden was more that sort of thing because he didn't have armed guards on his house preventing him from leaving.
That's Carlotta Gall from The New York Times on this program yesterday explaining how she thinks that a theory being peddled by journalist Seymour Hersh might be credible. Hersh believes the Obama account of the taking of bin Laden is a politically convenient myth that conceals just how much Pakistan is calling the shots in the war on terrorism. Hassan Abbas is a senior advisor at the Asia Society and author of The Taliban Revival. He's a former Pakistani government minister who served in the administrations of Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto and President Pervez Musharraf. Hassan Abbas, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
So is there a dispute between the United States and Pakistan regarding the status of Osama bin Laden just before the raid on the Abbottabad compound?
I think, yes, there was this dispute as regards the U.S. concern that Pakistan should have known. I mean, I would refer you to a statement by Secretary Hillary Clinton at that time. She went to Pakistan a few months before this whole Abbottabad operation, and she publicly warned Pakistan. She said, well, someone somewhere should know about bin Laden's whereabouts. I think that shows me that there was this effort from United States to figure out at that time, before the raid, whether there was some official sponsorship of bin Laden or not. And yes, there was this consistent suspicion on the part of United States that Pakistan is at least not doing enough to find him, but also that there may be some low-level officials somewhere who have some information. But what happened after the raid is, I think, a different story.
Well, it goes beyond suspicion. Seymour Hersh is reporting that, in fact, there was a walk-in source who collected $25 million from the United States to give up the location of bin Laden. Other people dispute that that walk-in source actually gave that information. But what do you believe?
I give a lot of credence to a gentleman, a former Pakistani Army brigadier who now lives in Canada, Brigadier F.B. Ali, a legendary Pakistani officer. He had written an op-ed just after the raid that he's aware that a Pakistani senior intelligence officer walked into the U.S. embassy in a Gulf country, because to say that some Pakistani official walked into the U.S. embassy in Islamabad is highly unlikely. That would be extremely dangerous. So I think FBLE might be right. Someone walked in a Gulf country, maybe UAE, and spilled the beans. But we don't know whether that person was directly working at very senior levels or he was part of a smaller cell. But I think that this is absolutely possible, somewhat likely, which also that President Obama, when he made that speech that we got bin Laden, very categorically said that there was some level of support from the Pakistan side which helped U.S. in this whole campaign.
But your colleague, Zahid Hussain, who wrote a book called Frontline Pakistan, claims that way up at the top of the ISI, there was support for bin Laden. General Hamid Gul, Army Chief General Mirza Aslam Beg, all part of a meeting where it was discussed that the ISI would protect the Taliban, that would protect bin Laden. And in fact, Zahid Hussain quotes Hamid Gul as saying that he has been hiding bin Laden for 9 years, and that was in 2007. So this went way to the top of the ISI. Do you not believe that that's true?
No, I believe that is true, but I must make a correction. They were supportive of this whole bin Laden thing in their private capacity, not as hardcore official ISI, but as retired ISI officials who had great links with bin Laden. I think that is likely, actually.
All right, so we are walking closer to a plausible theory here that there was a wide understanding within the Pakistan government, retired and official, that bin Laden was being held somewhere in Pakistan. So the question then is, do you believe the raid was an actual covert operation, or do you think it was staged? If the Pakistanis could have given up bin Laden at any time, why would the U.S. go in with this Navy SEAL team?
That is the area where I become uncomfortable with this whole theory and with Hirsch. I don't think that was a cover-up. I think that there was some level of alert or warning that was given to Pakistan. And the reason why I believe that is because this operation was very sensitive. It was paramount for the United States that the raid should not be detected and hence not be intercepted. So even an attempt at interception from Pakistan could have led to a disaster. It is therefore, I'm arguing, it was a risk not worth taking. I think it was very real. There were a real team which went in. The helicopter crashed. Hirsch and many others, in my view, who are making this claim that this was staged and the people or the president of the United States lied. I think they are all being very political, trying to discredit this administration's effort. I think it was a big success to get bin Laden. And we just cannot take that away from this administration.
Hassan Abbas, you've been very helpful. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Hassan Abbas is a senior advisor at the Asia Society and author of The Taliban Revival, published by the Yale University Press. You're listening to The Takeaway Podcast. I'm John Hockenberry. Here's a quick appeal. The more subscribers we have, the easier it is for us to attract the sponsors to keep our show going. So if you like the program, please let folks know. A Facebook like or a follow on Twitter means so much. Thanks again for downloading this podcast, which is brought to you by the fine folks at WNYC and Public Radio International. Is America falling apart, and whose responsibility is it to fix? In Philadelphia, where that Amtrak train went off the rails, killing 8 passengers and injuring dozens, one of the busiest train corridors in the nation is now being assessed for safety. The National Transportation Safety Board says the train was traveling at more than 100 miles per hour. That's more than twice the speed limit on that stretch of track, which suggests there was nothing wrong with the infrastructure. But slow 50-mile-per-hour tracks are a symbol of this country's backward rail technology in an era of bullet trains. There are also automatic braking systems, some that were even being considered for these Northeast Corridor tracks. And yesterday, a House committee even voted to cut Amtrak funding following the crash. Mayor Mick Cornett of Oklahoma City is part of a coalition of mayors urging Congress to increase spending on transportation. And he joins me now. Mayor Cornett, welcome to The Takeaway.
Good to be with you.
Now, you have joined this coalition, which includes your Democratic colleague here in the city of New York, Mayor de Blasio. What do you find in common with mayors whose political outlook you might not completely share?
Yeah, there aren't a whole lot of issues that Mayor de Blasio and I probably do agree on, but infrastructure is one of them. And we're finding a lot of collaboration, when members of Congress on both sides of the aisle. You know, being a mayor isn't necessarily a partisan position to begin with. You know, a lot of what we do are not partisan politics. But Mayor de Blasio and I both realize how important this is, and we've traveled enough to know that America's falling behind, and the deferred maintenance that's building up inside of our cities is frightening. And it's in a sense, it's a ticking time bomb for America.
And this is the kind of thing that you learn from your dad. When you open his toolbox and he tells you, don't defer maintenance. Don't, keep up on the maintenance, or your bike or whatever it is going to fall apart. This is just the oldest rule in the book. Why does Congress keep getting this wrong?
Well, you're absolutely right. When I was a child, my mother was a school teacher, and every summer she'd have a project around the house. It might be to paint, or it might be to get new carpet. But she instilled in me this need to continue to invest in your house, because you can't do it all at once. You have to do a little bit at a time to keep your house up. And that's what America is not doing with its infrastructure. We're getting further and further behind. And the short-term fixes that Congress seems to be enamored with, an extension here and an extension there, doesn't give the state departments of transportation, any way of planning long-term. Our DOT will say, look, we can build it if we know the funding's going to be there. But these short-term fixes just aren't appropriate or helpful. We need a longer-term funding bill. Senator Inhofe, who's my senator and chairing the Transportation Committee, is pushing for a six-year funding bill at some point this year.
In strategic terms, the highway system in the United States was funded for a long time, and I still think the strategy is there, although maybe not the funding right now, but was funded on an endowment strategy where you keep money in a trust fund, which is there for that maintenance when you need it. Why is that not the case for other infrastructure?
Well, one of the problems has become that as technology has improved and cars are driving more miles to the gallon, it is not allowing the trust fund to be funded in the manner that it needs to be. And so as new technologies come along, and of course you have people are driving electric cars, they're not even buying gasoline. And so we're seeing these technologies improve, but the funding for infrastructure is not changing. And again, it's inevitable that it's going to have to. But at this point, changing the gas tax doesn't seem to be even something that Congress is willing to discuss. So right now, we're just talking about the length of a transportation bill and really not getting at the root cause of it that you're bringing up.
Would you support a strategic rail system between points in the United States to take some of the pressure off the highway system that communities like Oklahoma City rely on so much?
Well, absolutely, because, as our nation's highways get more and more crowded, I think our citizens are more and more interested in some sort of rail-based transportation, whether it's a streetcar or commuter rail or transportation between one city and another. I don't hear of people in a single city saying they want less passenger rail. My city, in our same state, Tulsa, people here all want passenger rail if they don't have it, and if they do have it, they want more of it. And Congress doesn't seem to be listening to that. The funding that they're giving Amtrak, for instance, is woeful, and the infrastructure that Amtrak is moving those trains along is decades and decades old. And I've traveled a little bit overseas and in Europe and in Asia, and I've seen modern transportation systems. I've seen what modern trains look like, and they don't look like ours.
And you'd have the option of going to a Mavericks game on a bullet train between Oklahoma City and Dallas. I mean, there are all kinds of options right there in your neighborhood that would create all sorts of investment opportunities.
That's right. And investments in infrastructure translate into jobs and economic development. We talk a lot about, the lack of supporting a middle class in America, and that's indeed, an issue that we're continually trying to address. And indirectly, supporting infrastructure is supporting jobs in the United States. And a lot of those jobs are blue-collar that could be very, very helpful to our economy.
Now, you're a Republican, and I'm not going to get you to endorse the New Deal or anything, but there are people who have described that the word infrastructure is kind of wonky. It's boring. It's a sort of thing that doesn't get people's passions up. And that Works Progress Administration, the kinds of words that were used during the New Deal to rebuild America are much better sellers of the message. Would you Would you say there's something wrong with this term infrastructure, that it keeps people from going, oh, boring infrastructure?
Well, and sometimes we think we should use the term, you know, roads and bridges, but it means so many different things. It could even mean water infrastructure for a lot of communities. But keep in mind, we're traveling on roads and we're using water systems, many of which were designed and constructed in the 19th century, and that should scare everybody.
All right. Where would you like to travel on rail from Oklahoma City?
Well, I think that the best way to build a national network would be to get us to, you know, larger metropolitan areas. So for us, that would be Dallas, and, you know, and for there, all points beyond. But
all right.
But you have to make it where it can compete with other forms of transportation.
He wants to buy a ticket to Dallas. Mick Cornett is the mayor of Oklahoma City. He recently wrote an op-ed about America's trains for the New York Times, co-written with New York Mayor Bill de Blasio, a Democrat. Mayor Cornett, thanks so much.
You bet.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program, performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
Oh, I love it. Please, how much is that Picasso in the window?
Picasso Femme d'Alger, selling it here. At Christie's, $160 million. Brett, it's yours. So
that's it? Christie's unloaded Picasso's Woman of Algiers for a paltry $179 million, when you add in the sales tax and fees. A priceless painting nabbed for the cost of a dime a dozen Boeing 767. It's a disgrace. And then 30 minutes later, Alberto Giacometti's sculpture Pointing Man went out the door for $141.3 million, including fees. These are not basement sale times in the art world. Christie's, in fact, has just seen the art world's first billion-dollar week. Prices and demand for investment safe havens has created a bubble not seen since before the 2008 crash, which means that it's likely that big urban museums bidding for the public are basically out of the running. Joining me now is Carl Swanson, editor-at-large for New York Magazine. Carl, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
What do you think is going on in the market right now? Is it a bubble? Is it parking of money looking for something safe, or is it an appreciation of art that's crowding out the museums?
I mean, there are a couple of answers here. I mean, yeah. One is, you know, whether or not it's a bubble, I don't think we'll know for a little bit of a while. I mean, in some ways, it's reflecting sort of larger trends in sort of capital accumulation globally. I mean, when you think about something like paying that amount of money for a beautiful Picasso, you're not buying it necessarily for its sort of intrinsic value. What you're buying it for is because you have that much money.
Right.
And the fact is, there are people who have that much money. And one of the things that was interesting about that sale was that, you know, Christie said that how many of the people who were buying at the very top of that market, meaning the people who were paying a lot of money, people that you know, caused that to be an $8 million a minute sale, most of those people, or I think he said all those people, have been in the market for less than 5 years. And that shows you something about, you know, these people are not sort of long-term collectors who sort of have like a big history in terms of like the value of things, in terms of connoisseurship, in terms of, you know, this object is something that will appreciate in value that can become a part of some sort of conventional, or as we know it, sort of cultural patrimony. It's something else. I mean, it's something else that's probably more akin to that $100 million penthouse or the several $100 million penthouses that we're always reading about in, up on 57th Street.
And this is the kind of thing that happens in the art market periodically. I mean, the Japanese money came into the market in the
Absolutely.
80s and changed things. I mean, there will soon be a time when you have to go
to Abu Dhabi.
Let's think
about the 1880s also. I mean, you know, I mean, a lot of what we think about as being, you know, this sort of august traditional like the Met and things like that. I mean, those museums, I mean, you know, Gertrude Vanderbilt Whitney, you know, in her way, you know, was starting a private museum when she started the Whitney Museum.
Right.
I mean, this is a long history. I mean, when you know, these are always sort of cultural trophies. What's unusual now, and what's sort of what causes us to talk about it, is the sheer amount of money, the sheer surprising amount of money. This is one of the things they spend money on. It's a way for them to sort of transfer wealth around the world. And it's a way for like someone who maybe is an emerging market, as they keep saying, you know, it's a way for them to sort of claim also, because they have this money, you know, it's a way for them to claim this
prestige.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely.
The Russians wanted to be players, so they collected the paintings that went in the Hermitage.
Mm-hmm.
And then absolutely. The Mellons actually bought those paintings when the Bolsheviks
completely
crashed.
No, absolutely.
And now we're looking at a real transformation in the art world. If you add the movements to the Gulf, you know, where the Guggenheim's going to have an annex in the Gulf. I mean,
some things that are happening in Doha. I mean, you know, the Sheikha of Qatar, you know, she was the one that spent $300 million not so long on something. For her, that's just money. I mean, her, you know, that's she wants to buy the best thing. She can buy that. And that is something, you know,
that we can't do.
No, I mean, if you think about, you know, I was talking to someone I know who works at a major museum the other day about this, and they were talking about how, you know, if you think about, like, you know, the people that have given, you know, money, you know, recently to museums, you know, you think about sort of like the Lauders who gave all this money, for example, to the New Whitney.
Right.
You know, they gave, you know, $130 million or something to build the New Whitney. That wouldn't even pay for one of these paintings. They wouldn't ask them to buy one of these paintings. It wouldn't make sense.
That's wild. I mean, what's the future of, I mean, say, for instance, you can go on to 70th and 5th Avenue and see the Frick, which was an old residence that's now in the state of maybe becoming a bigger mm-hmm. museum. Is this the natural occurrence of things where these private collections that actually live in some human space gradually move into an inhuman sort of museum space and then eventually, you know, become these trophies that maybe end up in under lock and key?
It doesn't happen in that order usually. I mean, in some ways, like the first two parts of that is actually the best case scenario, which is that, like, you know, you have this very wealthy person who accumulates all this and they want the sort of social prestige, maybe sort of the aesthetic transformation, the mystical aesthetic transformation of owning these objects. And then historically what's happened is that then they would give these objects to museums either for estate planning purposes, far exceeding any estate planning purposes that you and I will ever have,
right?
Or there's some other sort of tax advantage. One of the things that's interesting right now is the rise of, and this has something, as I understand it, to do with the tax code, the rise of the private museum. So you basically get to have all the tax advantages of owning this art and sort of like allowing, you know, it to ostensibly sort of be in the public domain without actually having to give it to, and this stresses out the museums because it means that they can't be players, especially in contemporary art anymore. And these are also the
people. They're tax-advantaged churches of individual wealth.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah,
and, you know, it's like Scientology. it is kind of fascinating.
What about in the art world itself? These people are in the art collecting business for just a few years. I'm wondering if they're going for the top-end things, if that depresses the prices for mid-level things, for de Koonings, or hurts emerging artists because the money is really looking for a safe bet.
Well, that doesn't seem to be the case because there's a lot of, you know, I guess the word that was used is froth in, you know, all the way across the entire market. There was some fear, I think, on the part of, I don't know if fear is the right word, but there was some commentary that maybe by inventing this new category of contemporary as well as more historic things that Christie's did, you know, by including a Monet in mm-hmm. there as well, that somehow they would sort of kind of shoot their wad with that. You know, there was some there's some commentary that has happened that would happen. And definitely their second sale was not quite as urgent as that one. But it's all relative. I mean, they did very well.
So if you own a Jeff Koons dog, you don't need to worry.
I don't think so, no.
Just where to put it.
It's true. I mean, it's there's always somebody out there.
There's always somebody out there, exactly. Carl Swanson, editor at large for New York Magazine. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And here's something to take with you today. A little sadly, public radio legend, Emmy Award-winning actor and writer Harry Shearer, the voice behind The Simpsons' tyrannical Mr. Burns and his number two Smithers, has announced he's leaving The Simpsons. He reportedly passed on the deal that was offered to the rest of the cast, but he tweeted last night, "Because I wanted what we've always had, the freedom to do other work. Thanks, Simpsons fans, for your support."
Are you saying boo or Burns?
I was saying Burns.
The show management said Mr. Burns will not go away, but they will try to cast him with the best voiceover talent available. Can I make a suggestion? Smithers! Smithers, get in here! Immediately!
Smithers, make me slap him! You call that a slap?
Oh. That's all for today, but if you want to take the takeaway with you, subscribe to our podcast. You can find us on iTunes and take us with you on your commute home from work. It's a great way to stay up on the news. Again, find us on iTunes or any other service you use to get your podcasts. And watch out for that plutonium. It can really be dangerous. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from LegalZoom. For over 10 years, providing solutions for business owners to get legal help, including corporate filings, legal plans featuring attorney contract review, and tax advice. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
PRI, Public Radio International.